Hi, everybody. We're back. Hey. Welcome to Pharmacists Out of the Box.
We are so excited to have, I think, our first guest, right?
Yeah. Yes, our first guest.
Yay.
Don't you know that?
No, yeah. I'm honored. I'm extra honored, actually.
We've kind of thrown a few surprises at him this morning. So James is here with us. He is going to talk to us about finances. I'm Brynn. This is Heather. For any of you new to viewing,
the Pharmacists Out of the Box.
Yes. So we're talking about finances, and you should not put all your eggs in one basket. So he's here to teach us his wisdom.
Yeah. And we started our day out actually kind of getting
self-care.
Ready for this moment. Brynn and I both did yoga this morning together. It was a first, another first for us.
It was fun to do yoga side by side with our wonderful friend Liz. She's intense and like amazing, all in one. It's awesome.
We threw Brynn into like the second level of class and we're like, oh, there is a first level. We probably should have brought her to. But
it worked out great. Yeah. It was good.
It was awesome. So, but now we're ready to talk about finances. We thought this would be a great topic that is probably very beneficial to students and to pharmacists both. I mean, all of us are kind of come from the same cut of wood where we've got financial things are very similar, whether we're students or practicing pharmacists already. So let me tell you a little bit about James. So I've known James for a while. James and I work together a little bit at the University of Florida. But James is actually part of an organization that's one of the country's leading fiduciary investors. And he's a co-founder of Chacon Diaz and DiVergilio Wealth Management, a fiduciary firm. And I'm sure he'll mention that a couple of times because that's really important to him. He's a certified investment management and analyst, which only 2% of investors actually earn that, so that's a big deal. And he's a certified financial planner. So I love how we do all this because it's something we do with most everybody we introduce on any level of organization or conference or something. But it does give validity to what James has to say. I mean, James is really knowledgeable, basically, is what all of that means and what he's about to tell us. So we're really glad to have him. And besides all that, the most important thing is he's a UF grad and alum. And he was named one of the Gator 100 honorees for one of the fastest growing companies founded by a Florida alum. So he's definitely still working with the university in many capacities. Mm-hmm. And he's an adjunct professor. And the fun thing is he's also a co-host of a podcast, the Gator Nation Football Podcast. So he's a podcaster. And he's also president of the Gainesville Sports Commission. So he's a very busy guy. So we're lucky to have James
to
share his wisdom with us for the next couple of minutes for you guys. So thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me. I had no idea that when I got here today, they were going to give me a basket full of eggs, which this is a prop for you. You're going to learn from this today. And they also wanted me to hold a chicken, which may or may not happen.
It's happening.
At some point in time. I didn't know we were going to be on video. So essentially, this is truly out of the box. So here I am. I'm honored.
Surprise!
I'm honored to be here. Yeah, this is fantastic.
So thank you. Thank you. So I'm really appreciative of you and your advice because James is very familiar with pharmacists. He is a financial advisor, of course, we mentioned, who has worked with pharmacists. So he's very clear and aware of what pharmacists have to deal with when it comes to school and loans and then getting out into the world and making the salaries that we make and then making the financial decisions then about life and moving forward that we all try to make smartly. But maybe you could talk first about, maybe we'll start at the beginning of us going to school and then we get our loan as we graduate. I know the students might have lots of questions on loans and what to do with their loans. Do you have any initial thoughts or advice for them on that?
Sure. Yeah. Student loans, most of you are probably going to have a federal loan coming out of school. And so nowadays, federal loans are at a higher interest rate. You might be at 6.8, 7.9, somewhere in that neighborhood. So upon graduation, one of the first things you're going to want to do is to look into consolidating your loans with a private company, a private bank or something like that. You may be able to drop your loan from 6.8 or 7.9 down to maybe 4.5 or 5. So you're going to save yourself some interest right away. And secondarily, you want to pay it back in 10 years or less. And in reality, anytime you have debt that's not productive debt, so you're not borrowing money to make money, you want to pay that off rather quickly. If not, the bank, or in this case, the government, is making compounding interest on you. Mm-hmm. And that's not what you want. So don't look at your monthly payment. Look at your annual payments. Look at how long it's going to take you to pay all your debt back.
Okay.
And then look at your total interest. So as a simple example, a lot of students will come out of school and they feel like I'm finally making some money. I'll start paying my loans back, but I want to do all of these things. And I can lower my monthly payment if I extend my debt from 10 years to 20 years, but that's going to wind up costing them a significant amount more in interest. Mm-hmm. So you're far, far better off just continuing along that path of paying it off in 10 years at the most. And a simple recommendation is this, just take 20% of your income and put that toward your student loans. And you'll pay that off generally within 5 to 6 years as a pharmacist. So take 20%, come right out of school, that goes to your loans, live under that budget, and before you know it, you'll be out of debt and ready to start, you know, really managing your resources well.
And that's really important to get out of debt so you have freedom. Like when you feel like you are obligated to make a certain amount, you can feel stuck in a job. So I really think students or pharmacists like find a way to get out of debt, especially school loans. You can't get out of that. Like
you cannot. Yeah. Student loan debt is the only debt that does not go away in bankruptcy. So you can't get rid of it unless you die, which is rather grim, but that's all you can do.
So did you mention this? I don't know if I missed it. Maybe there's consolidation you can do?
You can consolidate with the federal government, but that's actually just a convenience measure. Okay. That's not going to lower or impact your interest rate at all.
Because they just average it all out.
Right, correct. Yeah. So that is nice. So if you have 6 or 7 different loans for whatever reason and you want to consolidate them into one, it does make paying it back easier.
Okay.
But in all reality, with today's interest rates, you'd much rather move your loans entirely into a private institution where you can get a lower interest rate.
So you mentioned try to do the 10-year thing. I know I've heard some people say, but my school loan's only 6% and my car is over here at 12 and my house is at, you know, well, my house would be cheaper than that, but, you know, should I pay the higher loan off first? So
yes.
If you do that, then there'll always maybe be a higher percentage loan though.
You should pay the higher one off first, but right now the highest interest rate debt you could get as a student, unless you're doing something really interesting like racking up credit card debt, which don't do that. But if you're not doing that, then the highest interest rate debt you're going to have is going to be your student loans. It's much higher than the market interest rate. So right now, you know, I could go buy a house. I could go buy
a car.
I get a loan from a bank for $500,000 today, and I'd get it at 4.5%. Mm-hmm. But if I wanted to go get my doctorate in something, I'd get a loan at 6.8%.
Okay.
And so it's much higher than the actual market rate because the government fixes the rates. They're not moving them, you know, fluidly like you would in the market. So it's highly likely that most people's debt coming out of school is going to be the highest debt they have. Mm-hmm. Again, unless they do something they shouldn't do, like incur credit card debt, which that might be 18, 20, 21%. So yes, answer to your question is always pay off your highest debts first, then go from there if you happen to have debts that are higher than that. But regardless, when your debt gets above 7%, that's like hair on fire, pay off your debt. That's like your number one goal in life. That's going to snowball against you so significantly that you've got to take care of that. When debt is below 5%, you can sort of carry that comfortably for a while and pay it off on time, knowing that you're getting good value for the money you're borrowing. And if it's in that in-between range, you know, 5 to 7, you want to pay that off with urgency, but it's not like your sole purpose in life is to pay it off like it would be if it climbed up above that interest rate of 7%.
Got you. And you just mentioned something that was one of the most interesting pieces of advice I've heard you say, because I didn't know it at all. And I know a couple people I've met who didn't know it. So you mentioned credit cards. And so as we make more money, we may have credit cards that we've gotten as we were students or as we were a young adult. And then we make more money and we can pay those all off and we no longer need those credit cards. Should we close them or should we not close them?
All right, you should definitely not close them. And so the way your credit score works is it's highly tethered to your original or longest standing credit card. That's your history. So imagine right now that you're a student and you're about to graduate pharmacy school and you've had a credit card for, let's say, 3 or 4 years. You've had it since you were an undergrad. Yeah. You get out of school, you go 2 or 3 more years and you think, hey, this credit card is really not great. It's not giving me any rewards. I'm going to open another one and close this one out. Well, if you do that and you only have 2 cards now, the new one you opened and the one that you had, and you close out the one that you had, your credit history is effectively gone.
Wow.
You no longer have a credit history. So your score just goes right down to nothing. It's a very silly system with regards to that.
Yeah.
But you do not want to close your longest standing card. So if you had a co-signed card with your parents, you want them to get off of that card. So now it's your own card. You want to keep that card open.
Okay.
And you want to keep that open for a while, really until you have, you know, a credit line of like 30 or 40 grand available through other cards. Then you'd be safe to sort of get rid of the smaller one. But you need that there to maintain your credit score. It's super important, especially if you only have one credit card. So that leads into another thing about credit cards, Heather. The more credit cards you open, the better your credit score eventually becomes. And this is a confusing thing. It's often misunderstood. But if the three of us each go get a credit card today, and then 3 months from now, we get another one, and 3 months from now, we get another one, and we never carry a balance on those credit cards, we simply spend what we're spending and pay it off every single month, our score is going to be significantly higher than the person that just opens one credit card and goes on. And the reason is very, very simple. Your path to getting a really great credit score is having a lot of available credit. That's how it works. So if you only have $5,000 of credit available and I have $50,000 of credit available, my credit score will be much higher than yours. Because they look at me and say, wow, James is managing all of this credit. He's really responsible. And so you actually want to use credit cards to get a top credit score. It's the easiest and best way to do it, and it should cost you nothing. You nothing. So my one simple tip for getting a credit card, when you open one, there's a little button that says pay this on time every single month automatically from my bank account. If you hover over that and your finger is shaking or there's some sort of trepidation or you feel like you can't do that, now is not the time for you to get a credit card.
Right.
But as soon as you can, you should do that. You should spend every single dollar you have on the credit card. Never use your debit card, because by using your credit card, you get protection benefits and you get rewards. So really, that's the smart way to utilize it. So I know Dave Ramsey tells you, don't use credit cards, put your money in cash. He's not wrong about that, because Dave Ramsey is catering to a much different audience than you are. He's catering to people that are heavily in debt, lack the self-discipline to manage their resources correctly. And he knows if he tells them what I'm telling you, they're going to go out and just put further debt upon
themselves. Get a bunch of credit cards.
Correct. But the higher level way to do it is to absolutely use a credit card, maximize those benefits, and in fact, open up multiple of them without fear. Your score will eventually be much higher. My score today, my credit score today is 820. Entirely from credit cards.
Wow.
I have no mortgage. I have no car loan. I have just that. That's it. Just credit cards. So I'm proof of it. It's the best way to do it. You can do it in 2 years or less. You can get an 800 plus credit score just using your credit cards.
Wow. Well, another reason to have multiple credit cards out where I work, it's very, I guess, theft prone with, you never actually lose your credit card, but it gets stolen. So I'm not allowed to fill up my gas anymore out in the city where I work. But it's convenient because it always happened like right before you needed a trip and you're like, ah, now my credit card doesn't work and I'm going away. So it is convenient to have more than one credit card. So you just got to keep up with it. And like you're saying, make sure you're paying it.
And a simple tip as well is, let's say that you get the Chase, you know, Sapphire Reserve or the Chase Reserve card, which is like $450 a year.
Okay.
And you get that because there's benefits and it's worth it and you travel a lot, right? You're going all over the place. But then eventually you stop traveling. You know, you get married, you have a kid, you can't travel for a while. So now you're thinking, what do I do with that card? I've got a $20,000 credit limit. I don't want to pay the annual fee. Don't close it. You can call any credit card bank you're with and tell them the simple thing. I want to downgrade my card to the no fee credit card. And every single credit card company has a no-fee credit card.
Okay.
Your credit history will stay perfectly intact, and you will keep your points.
Ooh. You'll keep your points.
You'll keep your points. That is super critical. People make a huge mistake and think, well, I don't want my Amex Platinum anymore. It's too expensive. I'm going to close it. No, no, no. Do not do that.
Okay.
Call Amex. Downgrade to their free card. Everything stays intact. That's what you want to do.
Awesome. Very cool. Thank you. Wrote down that tip. I like it.
That's cool. And points are awesome. So for those of you who know, you probably all know, but points are awesome. Points are free money. Points are free travel money, free cash money, you know, so points are awesome.
Yeah, the GM card goes towards your down payment on a car, or I don't know, you get some sort of stuff off
of there's airline miles one. Ours just gives us points and we can cash them out or we can turn them into airline miles or whatever. And we use our credit card for pretty much every bill we possibly can, like our cable bill, our cell phone bill, everything, because those are huge bills that we get lots of points on. And so it's just free money. That's basically free money.
And Heather, one last thing on credit cards. Don't ever use the cash option.
Oh.
Cashback cards are not what you want.
There's a little cash.
Never turn your points into cash, ever. So you can actually calculate the value of your points. And so it's a simple example. Most people that travel, the reason they love credit cards is you can get a 10x return on your points. So for every point you use, it's a 10 times valuable return. So imagine X amount of points equals a first class ticket. First class ticket to Australia cost $8,000, right? So we can calculate the exact value of points you get from that. If you use the cash back option where you say, hey, I've got 100,000 points, cash it out and give it to me, that's the best case scenario for the credit card. It's paying you the least for the amount of points you generated.
Wow.
You're still getting something.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that it's bad, but if you're looking at maximizing your value, you'd much rather actually spend the points, whether it be on hotels or flights or other things. You're going to maximize that value.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I always cash them out. Uh-oh.
I know.
I'm always the person who's like, don't do what I do.
But in fairness to Heather, I will say that Heather is a savant at the 0% interest credit card game.
We
could spend a whole podcast talking about if you found yourself in some sort of debt situation, you can use 0% interest credit cards to balance everything out. And I've never seen anyone better than Heather. So
you might want to do
a podcast on that one. I mean, we saw the spreadsheet and I was like, this is amazing. This is incredible stuff.
Yeah, well, when you live on a student salary and you're living on loans, like you learn how to do these things. So we were survival. That's all it was. But so you get this great score, right? Mm-hmm. So the goal is to like get that 800 credit score. And then you're like, okay, well now I can go to the bank and I can get a mortgage because now I have this great score that they'll definitely give me a loan and I can get a house.
Correct.
So do you have any particular advice on...
I have lots of thoughts on that, actually. and before we transition to that, let's put the bow on the credit score, because how important is it to have an 800 versus 600 credit score?
Yeah, what's the
difference? Does that matter? Does it not matter?
Not that big a deal.
So it's typically around 2% per year on your interest.
2%.
So if you're going to buy a $300,000, $400,000 mm-hmm. house, you know, you borrow $200,000, mm-hmm. the amount of that interest over 30 years in your loan is going to wind up being, you know, $20,000 or $30,000.
Jeez.
That's how much that difference is. So it is significant to have a really good credit score. I mean, it is significant.
Wow.
And it's not hard. It's automatic. You can do it just with a little bit of discipline. 2 years from now, you'll have that score. So if you wanted to buy a house, should you buy a house?
Yeah, should you?
Now, step one is if you're coming out of school... Absolutely no, you should not buy a house. No matter where you're moving, no matter what's happening in your life, if you're married right now, assuming you're young and you're starting out with your household income,
right,
assume your husband or in the other case, you know, your wife is not making any money yet either.
Right.
That's a simple case. No, don't buy a house. Get settled somewhere, figure out what's going on in your life, then you can buy a house.
Hmm.
Okay, now if you're somewhere down the road, you feel like you want to plant your roots down, it's time to buy a house. Mm-hmm. Should you buy a house as an investment? Let's ask that question first.
Of course a house is an investment.
Of course, right? It's maybe the best investment. 8 out of 10 Americans think that buying a home is the best investment they will make. The best. Better than anything else they could do.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when you look at the math, buying a home is not even an investment under the technical definition of an investment, which is an investment should have a positive expected return.
Yeah.
Homes do not. On average, in America, homes are going to lose you about 11% per year.
Wow.
Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait a minute. My mom, dad, cousin, sister, friend, brother bought their house at $100,000 and now it's worth $200,000.
Yeah.
Bought their house at $300,000, now it's worth $500,000. So it's appreciating, it's going up.
Hmm.
Okay, well, there's two things going on there. One, the past 10 years have been a nice housing bubble run up, right?
True. Mm-hmm.
But two, more importantly, they're not factoring in their costs at all. Property taxes, mortgage, maintenance, mm-hmm. insurance, mm-hmm. what they're putting into the home. So very few people estimate their costs at all.
Right.
Now, I've written about this subject extensively. So you can go to my website, cddwealth.com, and you can read.
We'll put that down below.
Read in depth. But what we're going to give you today is sort of the snapshot answer.
Okay.
Is that if you go to Stanford or Yale or Harvard and you ask their real estate professor, is buying a home to live in an investment? They will unequivocally tell you, no, it is not. It is not an investment. So what's really interesting is then why does everyone think that buying a home is such a good investment? And we could spend an entire podcast kind of unwrapping that. We won't do that today, but the spoiler alert answer is the government basically kind of makes you think it's that way. It's been that way for 50, 60 years in this country. There's a big narrative in America that if you buy a house, then the economy is going to do well. So the government feels like buying homes stimulates the economy. So they want to incent you to buy a home. There's a lot of messaging for that. They force the banks to make the lending easier, yada, yada, yada. If you're a Seinfeld fan, you'll get that reference. But essentially, buying a home is not a good investment. So what does this mean for you? It means that if you're going to buy a home, the smaller the home you buy, the more wealthy you will become, assuming you're using the extra money, to invest with. And so what does this mean for renting? Is renting lighting your money on fire? Is that a terrible idea? No. In fact, if you wanted to make yourself as wealthy as possible, you would never buy a house. You would rent your entire life.
I've heard this concept before.
You would rent entirely. Now, I'm not saying you have to because I own a car and cars depreciate. They're not investments either. So what do I want you to do? I want you to look at your home as what I'm going to call a use asset. Something you use and like and enjoy, but it depreciates.
Mm-hmm.
If it happens to make you money because you live in the right location or the area you're in takes off, that's great. It's a bonus.
Bonus, yeah.
But do not count on that. Do not look at it that way. So there are reasons to own a home, but primarily your spending rule for buying a home is this. You want to buy a home that's 2.5 times your gross income. So imagine you make $100,000 as a pharmacist. A $250,000 house is what your target would be. Now, most banks would tell you if you're making $100,000, well, Why would you live in such a small house? I'll give you a loan for $300,000. You can buy a $600,000 house. You don't want to be that person that's going to make you less wealthy over time.
Yeah. Less wealthy over time. Or to keep you stuck in a job.
To be married
that
to
you don't like.
The house.
Yeah. Correct. So not only does renting give you flexibility, but if you imagine two people, let's say that Bryn, let's say that you buy a home and you put $30,000 down and Heather rents, and instead of putting $30,000 down, she invests it. And we follow your lives throughout time.
Yeah.
Heather is going to have more money than you.
Yeah, I want Heather's bank account.
And and she's going to wind up saving more by renting. So both renting and buying lose, right? They're both downward. You're losing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But renting loses less.
Interesting.
And now let's imagine life happens, okay? Everyone knows that life is not predictable. If you're in school right now, you may think life's predictable. I'm going to get a job.
It's not.
This stuff's going to happen. I'm going to get not the way it's going to be.
No.
And so something's going to happen that you're not sure. Well, Heather is super flexible. She's renting. She can go anywhere.
Plus
there's no cost
yoga.
To pick up. Yeah, and she does yoga.
Yeah,
also
flexible.
Very flexible, literally. But she can go anywhere, do anything, and you're stuck.
Yeah.
And now what if you have to move at the wrong time? Now the market's down, you can't sell your home, and all of these costs are going to incur upon you, and now you're going to go to your next spot and you're going to buy a house.
Wow.
And so that can be a tricky, tricky thing. It's a little bit weird if it's the first time you've heard that, you're thinking, this guy has got to be crazy.
Because you're
buying a home is so sound, it's so much, it's just wasteful to do this. I promise you the math is very clear. This is not even a controversial subject amongst the experts in real estate. It's just a known thing.
Wow.
So this is a myth. It's a myth that I'm busting right now. I'm not saying home ownership is bad or evil. I'm trying to get you to understand that it's not going to make you money. You should not look at it that way. The more money you put into your home, the less wealthy you will become, assuming you're employing a better strategy on the other side. And that's the key too, is if you're just renting, but you're not investing any money, you're not doing the right thing either, right? So that and people will say that. People will say, well, wait a minute, isn't a mortgage like forced savings? And that's an idea people have. It's making me save to get equity
and you get
in something.
Equity,
And that to me is one of those ideas in life that you're like, well, that's a horrible strategy. Why don't we look at one thing and then look at something that's worse than it to justify our behavior? Which you could think of this in anything. We could make all sorts of funny examples of it. But you know, forced saving to buy something that's going to lose you money makes no sense. So a really good financial rule in life is do not borrow money to buy an asset that costs you money. You're doubling your pain.
Yeah.
Borrowing money to buy an asset that costs you money does not make sense when you can avoid it.
Yeah.
This is why a lot of people will tell you, wisely so, to eventually buy your cars in cash. Because you don't want to borrow money to buy something that costs you money. Why would you do that? That's costing you more money. You're losing more money. It's a double whammy. So that makes sense. Homes are really the same way. Ideally, you love to buy your home in cash. That's pretty unlikely, right? But ideally, you would because it's going to lose you money. And so you would rather have that scenario, or you'd rather have a really low interest rate.
Okay.
Which, of course, in today's environment, we have very low interest rates. Like pop quiz, what do you think the average mortgage rate throughout U.S. history was?
U.S. history.
Yeah, it's 4.5 right now. What do you think the average was?
Oh gosh, it was like, I'd say it's like 10%.
I was thinking like 8.
Yeah, they're 10. Yeah, 8.6. 8.6. That's the average. Now it's been much higher, right? But that was the average. Most of the time it was 8.6. So it's super cheap to buy a house right now, which is encouraging people to buy homes, which means right now, do not buy a home right now. If I could give you a warning, historical home price right here. This is the mean. This is where we are now.
Yeah.
2008 when the market crashed, this is where we were.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we've climbed all the way back up there.
Back up.
Now, again, I just told you the homes don't appreciate.
So
there's no reason why homes should be going like this. But they're doing it. Don't buy a house right now. Wait, eventually it'll come back down, then you can buy a house. Be patient.
Very interesting.
It is.
Might get some good deals then.
Sorry, my mind's already going. Yeah.
Racing. It's racing.
Honey, we're selling the house. When you're talking about, and if you do that scenario of the renting, you talked about then investing is the other piece. So I think we could wrap up maybe with talking about that because that's really important because you can't just forget about the money you're going to need tomorrow just by thinking about today.
That's right. And let's talk about the most important thing that I'm going to discuss today, which is this right here. Let's imagine this is your income because I really want to use this back. This is your income. Here it is. This is $100,000, let's say.
Okay.
The most important thing you are going to do for your future is this. You're going to take 10%, 10% of your income, your gross income.
Okay.
Now, what's your gross income?
$100,000.
What is gross?
Gross
means what?
All of it. Like what comes in.
Yeah. Before tax.
Before
you get taxed. This egg has not been taxed. You're going to take this egg out. 10%. as soon as you start making an income.
So wait a minute, make that clear again.
As you start making an income, here's your 10%.
So not of the check you receive.
No,
not
of your gross.
Check that you
so,
receive.
So
but
you
look
sign
at
your contract
number.
At okay. Publix or somewhere else and you make 105 grand, 10% of the 105 grand, this egg is coming out.
Okay.
This egg right here is going to get invested.
Okay.
And we're not going to talk about investing today because it would take another podcast.
Yeah,
but
way long.
That's important. You need to invest correctly. You're going to invest this money. This gets invested. This is as soon as you start making an income.
Now, when you say investing, are you saying like stocks, 401k?
We're talking about, yes, we're talking about stocks, right? So 401k or those sort of things are like, they're like the garage that houses your investments. But what you put in there, what you put in the garage is what gives it value.
Okay.
That's the investment. Investing, obviously, super important, something maybe we covered in a different podcast.
Okay.
But for now, 10% of your gross income has got to be saved immediately. 10% is not a magical number. It's the mathematical number that will allow you to replicate your lifestyle when you retire, no matter what your income is. So if you make 400 grand a year, I make 50 grand a year, Heather makes 200 grand a year, and we all save 10%, all of us get to retirement and maintain our standard of living.
Okay.
Only if we invest it. If we take this 10%, we put it into cash. We put it under our mattress. We put it into very safe investments like CDs or bonds. That we are not going to have enough money.
Okay.
Because over time, inflation is going to erode our egg away here. And we're going to have like half an egg.
Okay.
We want to have a lot of eggs by the end, right?
Yes.
So 10% comes out. So now imagine that you're in debt. We've taken our 10% out every single year. Forever, we're going to do that. We talked about student loan debt. 20%. One egg.
Two eggs,
right? 20%.
Okay.
This goes to pay back your student loan debt. So for the next 5 or 6 years of your life, you have three eggs coming out of your income. That's going to take care of your student loan debt, and that's going to take care of saving for your future. You want to do both of those things at the same time. A common error people do is they say, well, wait a minute, I'll just pay off all my student loans
and then start investing.
You don't want to do that because the odds are actually good your investments will make more money than what you're paying back on your student loans. So 6.8% is probably going to be lower than what you're going to make on your investments. Right? We can't guarantee that in the short run, but probably. Right. So you want to do both of them at the same time. Then you have all of these eggs left to decide how you want to spend them. What I know you're not going to do is you're not going to buy a house. Right? These eggs can be used for all sorts of things. Don't buy a house yet, right? But seriously, this 10% egg is the most important thing we're talking about. Right now, if you're 50 years old in America, half of the Americans at the age of 50 have nowhere near the amount of money they need. Not nearly enough eggs to retire in the next 10 to 15 years. It's a serious, serious problem.
Yeah.
No one is really addressing it because how do you address it? It's affecting all sorts of things.
They won't get their meds.
Correct. So this is the world we live in. If you do this, you will be far wealthier than you would have been if you had worked 30 years ago and had like a pension or something very secure.
Okay.
Far wealthier. But if you do not do this, you will be far worse off than you would have been had you had like a pension. So it's very polarizing.
So we need to teach this in like grammar school or like middle
really,
high
essentially,
schools.
Yes.
Like everybody, like your job, save 10%,
that's
invest it.
So take this Easter egg, paint it, color it, treat it well, right? Real farm egg right here, actually.
Yes, they taste
delicious.
Do not crack this and eat it. You save it and invest it. That's the key. 10% of gross. And then investing is obviously a very important topic. Probably one thing we can talk about is investing is very scientific. So it's not the Wild West. It's not gambling. And it's definitely not luck. So one little tip that I can give you today is do not invest in individual stocks. Don't go out and build a portfolio of individual stocks. Most people do this. Most people's first foray into investing and start making money and say, oh, I'm going to pick some stocks I like.
I'm
like this
Amazon,
company or
Pepsi.
That company. Individual stocks are too much risk for the reward they offer you. They don't offer you enough reward for just how risky they are. And so you're far better off doing what Warren Buffett says and buying an index fund or something that is diversified, right? All of these eggs right in here. So if you imagine this is a one stock portfolio right here and this is a bunch of US stocks right here. This one will get the same return as this one, but this one has a way greater chance of breaking.
Right.
If one of these eggs totally breaks, we have eggs left. If this egg breaks, we're dead, right?
Yeah.
And so the risk of that is not worth it mathematically. This is much better. This is much better. This will make you wealthier in the long run, although this feels a lot more fun, which is why people do it. Because they can tell their friends, I picked this stock, I'm making all this money. And human nature, your behavior is your worst enemy. I promise you. That's one thing you have
to
master.
Worst enemy.
Master your own emotion because we are all our own worst enemies.
That's why we do yoga, right?
That's right. Well, and I'll just say, like, we all know it. We've heard it forever. And the younger you start or the earlier you start with that 10%, then the of course, that curve goes a lot longer than like when you start later.
The more you'll make. I mean, Albert Einstein called compounding the greatest force in the universe.
Wow.
And Albert Einstein discovered a lot of incredible forces in the universe. But compounding was the greatest one. Nice. And if you start investing right now, let's imagine you start now, and Heather and I wait 5 years, and each of us give $300 a month to invest in, we get the same exact return. Your return is my return is Heather's return. At the end of a 30-year period, you're going to have like $250,000 more than we will have saved up. But you're only going to have saved like $18,000 more.
Wow.
So you put in $18,000 and you get $250,000 more just by starting 5 years earlier.
Right.
If you wait 10 years, now we're talking about $500,000. And that's what a lot of people do, right? Most Americans nowadays don't start investing into their 401ks.
And then you got to put like
until they're 32 or 33.
Away.
Yeah, to catch back up.
Just to catch up.
And now you're reaching the most expensive times of life because your kids are going to college, you're saving for
getting
all these
married.
Things, and then you're winding up saying, well, I hope my kids make money to save me.
Yeah.
Which, again, goodness. 10%, one egg, that will save you from all the heartache. Just take this egg, invest it, good to go.
That is great advice.
That is good advice. And then I get scared because I'm getting closer and closer to retirement. And, you know, they talk about Social Security going away, all the other supplemental things that we think, well, if I don't have enough money, I'll live on Social Security or whatever. Like, that may not exist. There may not even be that.
Yeah.
So it is really, it's something to think about. And when you're young, I think it's hard to think about needing money 50 years from then or whatever.
It's very hard. So let me end my segment. I know we're at the 31-minute mark.
Right.
I see it. Let me end my segment with this. Most of you are not going to want to do this on your own. And in reality, all of you should not do this on your own, which means you should find someone to help you. This is not that simple, unfortunately, because the finance world, the financial planning world, and the investing world are primarily a sales-based world. It's slowly changing, but it is not the pharmacy world where you have an oath to do what's best for the patient and there's a standardized education. It's not that way. So you have to be very careful, which means there are two things you have to look for. Assuming you're coming out of school, your job is to find a fiduciary. And a fiduciary means someone that's going to legally have to do what is in your best interest. Now, on average, 1 out of 10 financial advisors are fiduciaries.
Okay.
If you're going, 1 out of 10, that's
if you're going to Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley or any bank or any insurance company, Northwestern Mutual, AXA, Ameriprise, they are not your fiduciary. They're salespeople. So that eliminates all of them in my book, right? Doesn't mean they're bad. Doesn't mean they're not even not knowledgeable. But if they can't legally do what's best for you, they won't take that oath. I wouldn't want to use them. Secondarily, you should all see, if you're coming out of school, you should all see a financial planner, a certified financial planner, a CFP.
Okay.
Only 1 in 5 financial planners have that board designation. Very, very important. So you want a fiduciary and a CFP.
Okay.
You should see them within the first 6 months of your job.
Oh, I like this time frame. That's good for...
So you get settled in, you get into your new city, and now it's time to see one, because if you do that then, you're gonna hit a home run for the first 5 or 6 years of your career.
Nice.
You're going to do all the right things. You're going to get out of debt. Everything's going to be great.
Gotcha.
And then at that point in time, you're going to start to build some of your investments, and then it will be time to find a fiduciary investor as well, which could be the same firm you're with, but then you want to start getting all the investments going correctly and start to begin to build that. You'll be investing during that time. But most financial planners are not certified investment management people. So sometimes they're both. I'm both, but that's pretty rare, right? Like we talked about, I think only 1% of the investment population has both of like an investment cert and a financial planning cert. So typically you can find it. But just know that when you're starting off, you need to get a certified financial planner who also works for a fiduciary firm.
Okay.
Everything we talked about today, you can turn your brain off and not think about it because they're going to do it for you. And that's really, I would say that's the most important thing you're going to do, because here's your last fun fact of the day. You should make more money from financial planning and investment management than you will earn in your career.
Yes.
So if you make $3 million over the course of your career and you do financial planning and investment management right, you should make at least $6 million from that. So it's that important.
Yeah.
So you need to treat it that seriously. Don't just think it's automatically going
to
happen.
Don't put it off.
Don't trust your brother, your cousin, your neighbor, your friend, right? You really want to choose somebody who's credentialed, because it will make the biggest difference in your monetary life.
And for pharmacy students, I kind of think about it this way. You put all this effort into going to pharmacy school to get the big payoff of becoming a pharmacist. So to me, it's the same. You owe it to yourself to put this away for yourself and plan for when you're going to need it later on. Another thing I think you guys do that's helpful from personal experience is when you get a job, they give you the opportunity to have 401ks. And then you have to pick which funds in that 401k you want to put all your, you know, you take your 100% and you put it into your different funds. And it could be a list. One of mine has a list of like maybe 8 funds, but one of them has a list of like 50 funds. And I don't know, they'll send you the prospectus. And if you want to read something to put you to sleep at night, you can read a prospectus. That's what he does. I count on him to do that. But, you know, unless you're an educated person in that world, I really have no idea to put 10% here, 50% there, 10% there to spread out my risk. I have no idea how to do that. Just in putting up your 401k, which most of us have to do when we have a job. So a financial person can also, is that an advisor or is that a financial planner that what helps with that?
It's both. Okay. I mean, typically you'd want a credentialed investment advisor to choose the investments for you. Mm-hmm. Financial planners can do that, but like we mentioned, very typically they're not specifically trained to actually, you know, have the right investment strategy per se. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you'd want someone who does that. And if you post things on the page, on your Facebook page, you can actually list the credentials you look for. One's called a CFA and one's called a CIMA. Hmm. And those are the two investment ones. So you look for a CFP for your financial planner and then a CFA or a CIMA for your investment manager. Okay. And all of them would have to be your fiduciary all the time.
Okay.
And you can imagine, like your example, Heather, if you've ever traveled abroad, pick any country you want to go to, you know, imagine we're in France. Okay. And we're sitting outside, sadly, you know, a half-burnt Notre Dame right now, which is a tragedy for sure.
Yes, anyone who's been there,
it's incredible. And you're eating at a restaurant and you see the menu and you can't read any of it. But your best friend is fluent in French. They can tell you exactly what everything is. They can talk to the waiter and say, here's the best thing to get. And that's really what a good investment advisor is going to do, is they're going to look at this thing that looks like it's in French to you.
Yes.
And they're going to say, okay, here's the things to choose and here's how much to do and here's the best way to go. And so they're going to navigate that stuff for you, which should, in theory, take like a ton of stress away from your life. You go to sleep not worried about, am I invested in the right thing? Do I have enough going into the right places? You have a plan. You know what you're doing. And it'd be like traveling to a country with a native speaker where all of a sudden it opens up all of these other opportunities. And generally it relaxes you. You're no longer worried about asking for directions or am I going to the best places? And that's the same kind of process that's going on here. It's just that your friend who speaks French is probably easier to find than a really good, trustworthy investment advisor and financial planner, which is unfortunate. It's changing slowly, but it's unfortunate. So I say that to caution. That's a very important choice. So be careful with that.
Okay.
And you also mentioned the fiduciary. You've mentioned that a couple of times.
Yeah,
that's a word to really look for.
Yeah. Fiduciary.
Fiduciary.
Yeah, we'll hold some chickens up here and talk about being their legal guardians. Take such good care of them.
Nice.
So you should not then put all your eggs into one basket.
You should not put all your eggs into one basket, which we did here, but this is like a metaphorical basket where these are different. Look at the different colored eggs, though. See, we have different things in here.
We have different
eggs in our basket.
My happy little chickens, my organic chickens.
I think it's time to go meet the chickens.
Yes, we will. But thank you so much, James.
Yes.
That was awesome. That is awesome.
Yes.
Now we're all going to be successful financial people. Successes. So, James is an awesome guest. Like I said, thank you so much. We're really excited. In the future, we're looking forward to having a couple of other guests that are going to be helpful in many different ways.
Yes.
So stay tuned in the future for our upcoming guests. We're excited to bring them to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you
so
much.
Have a great week. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Nice. See, I made use of the eggs. There you go.